You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and it is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. Our panel today, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Rebecca Boone, the supervisory correspondent for the Boise Bureau of the Associated Press, Margaret Carmel, a senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, and our own legislative correspondent, James Dawson. Hi, everybody.
Happy Friday.
So before we get into our conversation today, listeners, we need your help. Idaho Matters is, Idaho as a whole, is approaching the one-year anniversary of the first confirmed COVID-19 case here in our state. And here at Idaho Matters, we are putting a program together with your voices. We want to hear how your life has been impacted and changed, the good, the bad, the ugly, over the last year. So send us a voicemail, 208-426-3625. Again, 208-426-3625. And we may just use your story on the air. Speaking of COVID, we have some breaking news coming into our newsroom. So we were told, I believe, earlier this week that subgroup 2.3 would become eligible for the COVID vaccine on March 15th. Well, just got a news release that in Central District Health's four-county jurisdiction, that's Ada, Boise, Elmore, and Valley counties, subgroup 2.3, you can start getting your vaccine tomorrow, March 6th. So wanted to give that information out as those timetables keep moving up, which is good news for everyone. Okay, I want to also start, Jimmy, with some other developing news, and that is there was a bill to make parents opt in for sex ed, and you've got some updated information on that.
I do, yeah. So that bill passed a House committee earlier this week, but just before we hopped on the air, as we're recording this, you know, around noon on Friday, March 5th, the House, full House, passed that bill on a party line vote. And what this bill would do, like you mentioned, parents would need to opt their children into sex education, aside from just a basic class that would teach a basic anatomy. And this bill has been coming around for about, I guess this is the third year in a row that it's been introduced from Idaho Falls Representative Barbara Ehart. You know, past iterations of this bill, 2 years ago, it passed the House as well. Last year got held in committee. The Senate's never really taken this up. And, you know, the arguments against it are that either some parents who might be working, you know, couple, three jobs maybe to put food on the table, or, you know, single parent households, it might slip through the cracks. You know, this wouldn't be part of, at least from what I gathered from the debate today, this wouldn't be included on the sheet that most parents get at the beginning of a school year, where you're kind of checking boxes on permission slips. This would have to come within 2 weeks of the classes actually taking place. And we should say that proponents of the bill are saying that, you know, Idaho has a very traditional view of sexuality, and some parents don't really want their kids to be exposed to, information about gender identity or sexual orientation that may be included in these classes. And these classes are approved by local school boards, and parents can currently opt their kids out of them. It was said on the debate floor that about 2% of parents opt their children out of these classes as they exist right now. And so this will now go to the Senate, where it may or may not be taken up in committee. We'll see.
So I also want to talk about the legislature rejecting a $6 million federal grant to improve early childhood education. A lot of stuff has come out around this, but Rebecca, can you explain just what the grant is and how it's been, and the fact that we've had it in Idaho before? Let's start there for people who don't understand the gist of this grant.
Sure. So this is a grant that came from the Trump administration. It's the second year that we've gotten it. And it just goes to support existing programs that help early childhood learning. Some of it can go to, say, if you're homeschooling your preschooler and you need some support there, or if you, if your child is in a daycare program that does like kindergarten readiness preparation. Some of it could go to library programs. And so the difference between the grant, actually between this year's version and what we previously had is this time it's going basically straight to the Department of Education, who is working with a local, who would have been working with a local nonprofit just to sort of distribute the money to childcare programs and other organizations.
Okay. And so then, Melissa, take it up from that point when it comes up on in the State House and Representative Charlie Shepard says something that basically has now gone national.
Sure. So to back up a little bit, there were a lot of concerns about this grant going through the Idaho Association for the Education of Young Children and some of the content that some House conservatives felt would be inappropriate for young children, you know, the Advancing Equity Initiative, that sort of thing. So there was lengthy debate about content and what might show up in these pre-K programs. Now, Representative Charlie Shepard, a freshman from the Riggins area, so central Idaho, said that he was concerned about any program that might make it easier for mothers to leave the household, as he felt that mothers were in the best place to provide that early childhood education for their children. This immediately caught the attention of a lot of people, especially some working mothers, many of whom, whether we decide to or not, we're just not in a position to provide that early childhood education for our kids. And it got picked up by media across the state. And the next day on the House floor, he apologized. He said, I'm really sorry. I was attempting to compliment mothers and say that they're fantastic at providing this education. And I see now that I failed. What I said was insulting and perhaps even sexist. And I commit to doing better. Later that day, there was a protest on the steps of the State House from mostly women in the Treasure Valley, who basically the tone was, that apology isn't good enough. We want the legislature to reconsider this grant. The grant was very narrowly voted down on Tuesday after that lengthy debate. It would have been a tied vote, except one representative changed his vote at the last minute to take advantage of a legislative rule that allows for reconsideration if somebody on the winning side, in this case, the no vote, says, you know what, I think we should take the vote again. That effort failed. At this point, the big question for me is whether or not the Joint Budget Committee will try again to get this $6 million grant, federal money from the Trump administration, as Rebecca said, if they're going to try again with a new appropriation.
And I actually talked to Representative Shepard yesterday, and he called me and he said, you know, I feel terrible about this whole thing, but to sort of help heal the wounds that my comments created, he said that he would support the bill. He would support the grant should it come forward again. So there's at least one person who previously voted no, who's now saying I would vote yes if it comes before us again.
And that's a key thing, because again, this would have gone down on a tie. You don't need the entire, the entire group of House Republicans who had voted no on this, and it was the majority of the House Republican caucus who voted no. You don't need all of them to sign on. You just need one vote to flip at this point. And so I think we might see a new attempt from the Joint Budget Committee to get that grant passed, as well as perhaps some of the other bills that either have already been voted down or maybe voted down in the coming weeks.
And I think it's one of those things that when, I think there was some skepticism, frankly, when Representative Shepard made the apology, right? Because, I mean, if you listen to it, I mean, it did sound heartfelt. I mean, it sounded like at times he got emotional in the apology where he said, you know, I didn't mean for my remarks to sound derogatory, to sound sexist. They were derogatory. They were sexist. But
right.
there are times, right? And but there are times when it's like, okay, if you're going to apologize, then put your money where your mouth is. And so, Rebecca, it is interesting that he's saying, you know what, he will support this.
Right. And I did talk to some women after the rally who said, look, you know, he apologized for the words that he used, but he didn't apologize for the sentiment behind it. And so, you know, who were deeply offended by the very idea that somebody would say, you know, you as a woman, your highest priority should be at home instead of perhaps earning the money that you need to, you know, raise your family or perhaps following your career that you're passionate about. So, you know, there's, I think you also have to take into kind of consideration the climate in Idaho for working mothers has not always been super great. I mean, it was only, what, 2018 when it became legal to breastfeed in public places. So in this state.
I appreciate, Rebecca, that you say that it hasn't always been that way. Because it feels like it's always been that way, just from a mom speaking.
So anyway, yeah, we'll see how things pan out from here. I mean, when I spoke to him on the phone, he was certainly very remorseful. But you know, we'll have to see what.
So then how does the process work then? If to bring this back up then, is that really a real possibility?
It's absolutely a real possibility, and we've seen it happen in multiple legislative sessions past. I mean, in the past 10 years, the legislature has voted down the public education budget, the higher education budget. This is not necessarily an abnormal move. And so what happens if the budget committee decides to take this up again is that they would work with the budget drafters, the legislative staff. They would craft a new budget, probably, you know, honestly, very, very similar. In the past, we've seen attempts at this that were almost identical, you know, within a few hundred dollars of each other in a couple cases. What you might see is something called intent language, which directs an agency to spend the money that they're given in a very, very specific way. We saw that this past week with the higher education budget and the appropriation that the committee gave to the higher education institutions, saying, you know what, we're giving you this money, but we want a report in a year, making sure that public, you know, state taxpayer dollars aren't going to these social justice programs that we're concerned about.
Yep. Gemma, it just has to be $100 different from the previous version of the bill.
Okay, so the likelihood is that we could see this come back, because that's a lot of money that is a federal grant to say no to.
It's a lot of money that the governor wants. He made that clear on Wednesday when he spoke with the media. It's money that the majority of the Joint Budget Committee wants. And remember, this was just very narrowly voted down in the House. Again, you only need a couple people to flip, just one person to flip, really, if everyone's there. And I would honestly be more surprised at this point if we don't see it come up again.
Margaret, there were actually other things going on at the State House as well. Can you fill us in? We've talked about this a little bit on the program before, but this rental fee bill.
Yeah, so Senator Ali Raabi from Boise brought a bill that would put some extremely minor regulations on rental late fees. And this bill would basically just require landlords to tell their tenants what the late fees are before they charge them. So right now in Idaho, you know, if you're a renter and you pay late, your landlord can charge you $1,000 a day. You know, they can charge you whatever they want and not give you any warning that that's what the fee is going to be. Her initial version of the bill did put in language requiring the fees be quote unquote reasonable, which means that a court could, you know, decide that would basically give the authority for a judge to decide in small claims court, you know, if these fees landlords are asking for from tenants are reasonable. But that requirement was taken out of the bill in the amending order. Senator Kelly Anthon requested that it be sent to the amending order in committee and then that reasonable requirement was taken out. I have not been able to get in touch with Senator Anthon about his opposition to that and understanding his perspective, but he was the one who sent it to be amended. The watered down version of the bill, which, like I said, would just require landlords to tell you what the fees would be before you pay late, did pass the Senate with bipartisan support. So we'll see what the House thinks of it. It should be popping up in a committee sometime next week.
Let's take a quick break. So much more to get to with our Friday Reporter Roundtable. Continuing with our Friday Reporter Roundtable, our panel, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Rebecca Boone with the Boise Bureau of the Associated Press, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, and our own James Dawson, who covers the legislature for us. So, Rebecca, can we talk about a bill in the State House that would define what an epidemic is in our state, but we should note that the current pandemic actually wouldn't qualify?
Right. So this is kind of an interesting thing. Our current list of sort of like natural disasters that lead to emergency, that can lead to like these sort of like emergency declarations, doesn't include pandemic. And that's probably because we haven't had a pandemic really in the past 100 years. But so this bill adds epidemic and pandemic to the list of basically like kind of disasters that the state can face. However, it also defines epidemic and pandemic, and it pulls those definitions straight from the Office of Emergency Management's documents that really were created for to detail the state's potential response to a influenza pandemic. I think it was the most recent version was from like 2018, and the state's been using that a lot as it sort of crafts its response to the coronavirus pandemic. Definitions in that, in the bill, define a moderate, they only define a moderate and a severe epidemic. And to be a moderate epidemic or something to qualify as an epidemic, based on Idaho's population currently, it would require, so we have about 1.78 million people, the bill would require at least like almost 447,000 residents to become sick, and like 6,700 of them to die before something would meet the definition of an epidemic in this bill. So, you know, we've had something, and I haven't checked today, but we've had close to, you know, 172,000 cases of COVID-19, and, you know, we're getting closer to like 1,900 deaths since the pandemic began. So that's well below, thankfully, we have not had 6,700 people die in Idaho, but under the criteria in the bill, coronavirus would not be considered an epidemic.
So we just haven't had enough people get sick and die yet. So that's the definition, basically. Okay.
Right.
Melissa. Go ahead, Rebecca.
I was going to say, you know, some of the opposition to this, so the bill passed. But some of the opposition came from people like Representative Steve Birch, who's a Democrat from Boise, who said, like, look, you know, if we had like a similar polio epidemic occur, like that also wouldn't meet the qualifications here, because polio in the 1940s, you know, was disabling something like 35,000 people a year in the U.S., but many of those stricken with polio survived the illness. So they weren't dying. They were just getting, you know, badly hurt by the disease. So that being said, the bill passed on a party line vote, and that's where we're at now.
So where does it go next?
It goes now to the Senate. And so, and it's part of this package of bills that have been kind of targeting the way the state has responded to the coronavirus pandemic.
And Melissa, with that said, the state this week released some limited data, correct, when it comes to demographics of who's getting vaccinated?
Right. And a little bit of backstory, this comes after the Department of Health and Welfare wasn't collecting this data for several weeks, the first several weeks of the vaccine rollout. At first, they erroneously believed that they were legally prohibited from collecting the demographic data. And then they found out, well, we just can't require patients to give it over. It's voluntary, but we are not actually legally prohibited from doing so. Then it took a while to get that demographic information up on the website. We finally saw it this week. And so for the limited data that we have, we only have the race and ethnicity for about half of the vaccine recipients so far. But in that group, there are racial disparities. We see that about 5%, 4 to 5% of those recipients are Hispanic or Latino, based on that data set. And that, you know, that compares to Idaho's population, where about Latino or where, I'm sorry, my cat just jumped on the keyboard, where 12%.
No worries. Don't worry about it.
Idaho's population is Hispanic or Latino. And so we're seeing big racial disparities here. And again, we don't know how that data lines up with that group that wasn't captured. We just don't know the race and ethnicity of the first half of those vaccine recipients. But for what we do know, it is concerning, and it suggests that residents, Hispanic and Latino residents in Idaho, just aren't being vaccinated at the same rate as white Idahoans.
And it's important that we note that and that information is out there. Margaret, now we know that the mask mandate was lifted in the Central District Health, and those counties recently. Boise Mayor Lauren McClain kept the mask mandate in place. However, just this week, she's kind of eased up on some restrictions.
Right. So Mayor McClain worked with Central District Health, and now there's a process that if you want to have an event with more than 50 people, you can get it approved through Central District Health. And, you know, I think a lot of people saw this and the initial thought was, well, people that are having, you know, parties with 50 people that are unauthorized are going to keep doing that. So what's the point?
Right.
But really what this does is it opens the door for large events to happen, like the Big Sky Basketball Championship and outdoor concerts later in the year, official events. And what they can do is they can go to Central District Health and submit a plan for how they're going to try to lower transmission, like requiring masks, distancing, all sorts of things. And if Central District Health reviews their plan and decides that it's comprehensive enough, they can approve that those events happen. And that, I think, is a really, it's going to be kind of the catalyst for reopening Boise economy, because there's a lot of, Boise's economy is driven quite a bit by events coming here, whether that's, you know, big conferences downtown, sporting events, things like that. And if these official organizations now have runway to put together these plans in a safe way, as vaccines are, you know, starting to roll out, cases are staying low for now, then it's going to sort of open that door for more, the economy to reopen again.
I want to take another break. We still have so much more to get to with our reporter roundtable. Some more Idaho Matters next. Continuing our reporter roundtable today, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, Mark Carmel with Boise Dev, and our own James Dawson joining us. Jimmy, some big blowback to Boise State this week as funding was cut. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this has been an ongoing fight for almost 2 years, I guess, now at this point. If you go back to 2019, you had a group of more than 24 lawmakers send a letter to new Boise State University president at that time, Marlene Trump, basically saying, you know, some of the social justice programs or diversity initiatives like multicultural graduations, fellowships for minority students, or even just implicit bias training were, quote, antithetical to the Idaho way. And, you know, these lawmakers and conservative lobbying groups have really never let Boise State out of their sights for the last 2 years. And so what happened this week was Representative Priscilla Gittings tried to defund millions and millions of dollars from Boise State through the budget writing process. Eventually, another motion made it so that it was just a $409,000 hit to Boise State, which Gittings and a couple other representatives objected to. But that's what eventually passed out of JFAC, the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee. So that will go to the full House and Senate for a vote. Whether or not that will pass the House or Senate, who knows at this point, if Gittings might be able to get some more opposition to it on the House floor, that's certainly a possibility. She also attempted to pass a bill out of committee this morning that would have separated the state's higher education budgets right now. Lewis Clark State College, University of Idaho, Boise State University, and Idaho State University are all in one, connected budget. And she wanted to be able to parse each of those out, theoretically, so that you could go line item by line item and take out funding for those kinds of initiatives.
Can you please correct me if I'm wrong? But my understanding, Jimmy, and maybe Melissa, you can weigh in on this too, is that any type of social justice groups, even if there have been programs that have been put in place in higher education in Idaho, has not been funded by state money. Is that accurate?
Certainly, a whole lot of those are funded by student fees, which is another target that some of these conservative lawmakers have tried to take out this session, making student fees optional for students. They can check which basically where they want their student fee dollars to go toward. But then you also have the argument that, well, the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, or even like a top dean level type position of diversity and inclusion, are, their salary and their benefits are paid through state dollars. But as for these programs, it seems like the majority, if not most, or all of that funding does come from student fees or some other type of funding.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, please, Gemma. No, please continue.
I was just going to add on to what Jimmy said, that absolutely, it really just comes down to how you define what resources are going to support this. So is the existence of a faculty member who helps out with a, LGBTQ club, if they're doing it without using any of the state dollars, because they are a state employee, that their benefits are going or coming from that state fund. Do you count that as a taxpayer funded initiative? And it really depends on who you're talking to in the legislature about that.
Yeah, and we should say too that as part of that budget bill, there was some language that was included in there that all of these four-year institutions will have to basically send a report to the state legislature next January saying that, no, we did not use any state dollars towards any of these programs.
And that's that intent similar, which I was mentioning before, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's exactly what you were mentioning, Melissa, when it comes to that $6 million federal grant with early education is having this report.
Right. On the surface, it seems like all of these things are disconnected, but a lot of it really comes down to these House conservatives who are frankly becoming more powerful. They're gaining more steam. And they have a lot of concerns about the content that is being presented, whether it's to young children or using state taxpayer dollars in the higher ed institutions. And that intent language might address some of those concerns. Again, there are some House conservatives who will never vote for these budgets for philosophical reasons, but you don't need every House Republican to vote for him. You just need a few votes to flip.
Have we heard from any private industries in particular about the higher ed when it comes to social justice? Because I know that some private industry, they want to see these. So I'm just curious if they've had anything to say or if they've remained silent.
I haven't heard anything specifically this year, but certainly, when you've had other legislative attempts, for example, last year with the transgender bills. You know, you had Idaho's biggest businesses and organizations come out saying that this makes it much harder to recruit to Idaho. You had Micron sign on to that bill, Idaho National Director, mm-hmm. the then director of the Idaho National Laboratory. I believe Chobani, HP, and a couple other huge businesses basically saying, look, corporate America does do these things. Fortune 500 companies are buying into these kinds of diversity and inclusion type programs. This is just how things are now. But seemingly that doesn't typically resonate as much. At least one of the transgender bills passed with the in relation to not letting transgender girls and women play on sports teams. That's currently going through the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals right now. So how much that resonates in the legislature, it kind of depends on each issue. But again, we haven't really seen too much this year, as far as I know.
I just want to chime in on this real quick.
Yeah, go ahead, Margaret.
I haven't, seen anything directly this session, like everyone else said, but I get a lot of press releases from Micron where they are highlighting their diversity, equity, inclusion. If memory serves, I think that they have flown pride flags at their location. I feel like I remember that happening, and I have heard that that company, because they are recruiting a lot of out-of-state talent to come here and work on their high-tech projects, and and they have been on that side. And so I think Micron is one of those companies that they have internal DEI programming that probably is very similar to what's going on in these institutions that the legislature is objecting to.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, to how you had mentioned, Jimmy, with the transgender issue going to the Ninth Circuit, Rebecca, you've done some reporting on some similar bills in other states, right? And when it comes to local sports teams and transgender athletes.
Right. And just a shout out to my colleagues, David Crary and Lindsay Whitehurst, who did the vast majority of this work. But the AP reached out to some 24 state lawmakers that are sponsoring similar measures to Idaho's transgender athlete sports ban around the country, and asked all of them that we could reach, basically like, hey, has this been an issue in your state? Like, are there any actual instances where participation by a transgender athlete on a team sport, especially a transgender girl in team sports, has caused any problems? And we couldn't find any who could mention local issues. In South Carolina, Representative Ashley Trantham said she didn't know of any, but she just wanted to prevent future problems. In Tennessee, the House Speaker, Cameron Sexton, said, well, there may not actually be any transgender students in our state currently participating in middle and high school sports, but we want to be proactive. And that really mimics, that's really exactly what Representative Barbara Eckhart in Idaho said when she began pushing this bill here. Opponents have said basically like this is a manufactured problem in search, or it's a solution in search of this problem that's actually not occurring. It's worth noting that most of the lawmakers, including Representative Eckhart here, have cited these two athletes, transgender girls in Connecticut, who were runners, sprinters, and they were super duper fast, and they were winning a bunch of awards and state championships. It's a very small portion, obviously, of our national population of girls who run track. So, right. And in one of those cases, one of the cisgender girls on the team who ultimately, I think, joined with the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is this conservative group that's been pushing a lot of this legislation, sued. But she actually, in February 2020, defeated the faster of one of her trans athletes in their final two races. So the idea that I don't know what that says about the idea that, you know, somehow trans athletes are going to always be faster or more athletic than cisgender athletes, but it's something that maybe is worth thinking about a bit, I guess.
Right, absolutely. We need to take another break. More with our reporter roundtable next. More with our reporter roundtable, our panel, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, and our own James Dawson. Jimmy, can you talk a little bit about where we are with the bill that would even further restrict ballot initiatives?
I can. And actually, that will be in committee on Monday. I guess that would be March 8th at 9 a.m. House State Affairs. The chairman, Representative Brent Crane, just announced that this morning, just to give a heads up to folks who may want to testify. And if you're listening, not currently right now at 12:48 on Friday. Anyway, right. So yeah, the Senate did pass that earlier this week. Basically, this bill would make it so, I guess, kind of a bit of a backstory. Currently, if you want to get something on the ballot, you have to go around to a little more than half of Idaho's legislative districts. There are 35 of them, and you have to get a certain number of signatures from those geographical areas. So kind of difficult. It's one of the more difficult processes in the country for states that allow that. And this proposal would make it so you have to get a certain number of signatures from all 35 of those legislative districts, which campaigns, most notably Reclaim Idaho, which I guess backed the successful Medicaid expansion initiative a few years ago, they're saying it would make it impossible to do. And this isn't the first time since the Medicaid expansion initiative passed back in 2018 that lawmakers have taken aim at the initiative process, and they do it every single time in recent memory that a ballot initiative that they don't like has passed. And so 2 years ago, Governor Brad Little vetoed a couple of bills that would have increased the amount of signatures you needed, lessened or decreased the time that you had to collect these signatures, and increase the number of districts that you needed to qualify for the ballot. So senators passed that significantly higher margins than they did 2 years ago. It seemed like not having as comprehensive of a set of new restrictions gave some Republicans who had some heartburn, you know, maybe they gave them a little bit of Rolaids or Tums or something and helped ease that transition. But so, like I said, House committee will take that up on Monday. People can testify if they so choose. And then it goes to the House as well, if it passes, okay. That is.
If it passes out of there. Melissa, so apparently this has been something going on for quite a while, but trying to decentralize the AG's office.
Yes, right now in Idaho, state agencies, most of them are represented by deputy attorneys general who are under Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin. And this has been a controversial practice for some over many, many years. This isn't a new debate, whether or not state agencies should be able to seek outside counsel and whether it's appropriate for Attorney General Wasdin to sit on the state's land board and also have his deputy attorney general represent the Department of Lands agency. And this has come up several times over the years. Most recently, there was a big fight in 2016 with then Governor Butch Otter saying that he agreed that the office should be decentralized. This year, the legislature proposed three separate bills. Two of them dealt specifically with the land board and Department of Lands, and one of them would have just allowed any state agency to seek outside counsel if they so choose. That last one that I mentioned, applying to all state agencies, mm-hmm. passed out of the House, is now heading to the Senate, and we'll keep an eye on that moving forward. But just now, in the last half hour, the House voted down with no debate the Attorney General's appropriation. So as we're having this discussion about Republican lawmakers using this budget process to protest what they object to with the use of some of these taxpayer dollars, we just saw this in the last hour in the House. They voted it down. 40 House Republicans opposed this. And so this, regardless of what happens policy-wise with allowing state agencies to hire their own outside counsel, the Republicans are making it very, very clear that they are not happy with the Attorney General.
And Rebecca, I think we need to talk about another Idahoan being arrested in connection with the Capitol breach. This happened, just yesterday, I believe?
Well, yeah. So the FBI announced the arrest yesterday. She was actually arrested Wednesday on a warrant out of Washington, D.C. that has, so she's been charged with entering a restricted building and then disruptive and disorderly conduct on restricted grounds. Those are charges that we're seeing pop up a lot with people who have been arrested and charged in connection with the breach of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. I'm sure everybody remembers what happened there, but you know, protesters and insurrectionists who were intent on sort of stopping the certification of President Joe Biden's election basically busted through the barriers, broke into the U.S. Capitol building during a rally in which President Trump encouraged them to, you know, go to the Capitol. And, you know, there were 5 people died, 2 police officers later committed suicide. There were many, many, many officers who were wounded. It was pretty horrific. Now this woman is, her name's Yvonne Orban St. Cyr. She's not yet had a chance to enter a plea. And, last I checked, although she may have an attorney at this point, but as of yesterday evening, she, the court records did not indicate if she had obtained an attorney. So she was arrested. She's accused of being part of it. And the FBI, agent who wrote sort of like, this is why I think we should get this, you know, this document that they always do that says, this is why we need an arrest warrant, sort of laying out what they believe is probable cause, is just full of information about, like, she is allegedly one of many, many people who were at the Capitol that day who, you know, sort of like live broadcast their actions and then posted it on social media and then later did videos like talking about it on social media. I actually watched hers the night, I think the day after, 2 days after the Capitol breach, just because I and many, many of my AP colleagues were tasked with sort of finding all we could on social media about the people who claimed to have been involved. And she was one of the people, based on the videos that I saw from her Facebook page, that, you know, posted videos of herself, like talking about, this is what we did, this is where I was, this is, you know, what it was like. It's pretty remarkable. This is one of those remarkable instances, I think, where a huge action occurs that, you know, the criminal justice system pretty clearly says, we think this all amounts to some crimes, but everybody involved clearly felt justified in their actions, at least in those moments when they were posting them and sort of like gleefully talking about them on social media.
And Margaret, as we wrap things up in about 2 minutes, can you talk about some issues with short-term rentals in the housing market? Because Boise Mayor Lauren McLean, she wants to act on some of this, right?
Yeah, we'll see what happens with it. So short-term rentals are Airbnbs, VRBO. You know, I think we've all probably stayed in one. And they're not always popular. Some people in the community really enjoy them because they can help them stay in their home by supplementing property taxes, or they can make more money by renting short term as opposed to having regular renters. But neighbors are frustrated with some of the impacts of having guests coming in and out, as well as there's there's some studies out there that say that Airbnbs and short-term rentals actually tighten the housing market further by taking units that could be rented off the housing market, and then it makes housing even harder to find. Mayor McLean said during the campaign, and she told me again last week, that she is open to, they're talking about bringing forward an ordinance that would require these short-term rentals to be licensed in Boise, which would mean we would know where they are and how many they are definitively. But that hasn't come forward yet. We'll see. And I think as the housing market continues to tighten, there's going to be more conversations about these Airbnbs, these short-term rentals, and what we should be doing about them, because I think that there is some growing frustration in the community.
Well, and it does play into the entire housing market, which we know is so incredibly tight. I want to thank all of you for taking this hour out of your day to come on the program, but also all of the reporting that you all do. It's so needed and so necessary. So tremendous thanks to Melissa Davlin, Rebecca Boone, Margaret Carmel, and our own James Dawson. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Jenna.
Have a good weekend.
Happy
Friday to you.
Bye.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters. So appreciate your participation, you being a part of our program. And our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Oh my gosh, it's Friday. It's beautiful. I hope you can all find a piece of joy in your day. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.